The projector starts, and so begins this episode of Movie Nights and Matinees, the podcast for people who enjoy movies from when we actually had to go to the movies. I'm your host, Bill Groves, and this is episode 28, Sing Me a Song, in which my guest and I take a look at a gentleman whose name isn't known to the average movie buff, but whose music enhanced many movies of the golden age of cinema. So, to set the mood, sit back and enjoy this piece of music. Hi, everybody. Thanks for listening. Before I introduce today's guest, I just want to mention one thing. If you listen to episode 27, you'll know that my co-host, Jim Reed, wasn't able to join me due to having been away at the Kansas Silent Film Festival. He'd planned to be back for this episode, but it seems that a certain bug had a different idea, and Jim's a bit under the weather, so I'll once again have to press on without his insightful input. On the subject of film fests, though, there's another major one coming up that I want to mention, taking place in May during the Memorial Day weekend. I recently received a very nice note from Samantha Glasser, who heads up the Columbus Moving Picture Show, previously known as CineVent. I know Jim's attended that in the past, and although I won't be able to attend, it's something classic movie buffs should be aware of. Just do a quick online search, and you'll find the website with all the details. Now, to the matter at hand. Fans of classic movies may or may not be fans of movie musicals. However, even when the primary thrust of a movie isn't a set of songs performed by the stars, songs still play a significant part of many films, whether it's something heard over a radio that appears in the scene, a tune that a couple is dancing to, or a musical performance by a supporting player, such as how the Andrews sisters livened up the early Abbott and Costello pictures. Most of the time, the creators of such songs go unappreciated, and in some cases unidentified in the credits. While movie buffs will likely be familiar with some names, such as Cole Porter, Harold Arlen, Irving Berlin, whose songs were utilized in multiple major films, one name that isn't so familiar is that of M.K. Jerome, known to his friends and colleagues as Mo. Yet his compositions supported scores of pictures during his career, no pun intended, especially during his tenure with Warner Brothers. Well, his life and career have been documented by his own grandson, Gary May, in the book The Tunesmith, The Musical Journey of M.K. Jerome, from Bear Manor Press. Gary joins me today to talk about his prolific grandfather and that impressive career. Gary, welcome to Movie Nights and Matinees.
Thank you for having me, Bill.
It's my pleasure. You know, I'm going to flip the chronology of your book on its head a little bit because you do take Mo's career chronologically and his life. But I want to jump kind of to the end by way of intro, which doesn't sound like it makes sense, but it's at that point where you really talk about getting to know him as a child and kind of discovering his career and everything. So first of all, maybe give us a little thumbnail overview of his career, such as what might be essentially the book flap.
Well, I would say that he was more important than people generally understand. This was a man who had two extraordinary careers, one as a songwriter on Tin Pan Alley and the second at Warner Brothers, and he had success in both places. He received two Oscar nominations for Best Song from Warner Brothers movies, Some Sunday Morning from Errol Flynn's San Antonio, and Sweet Dreams, Sweetheart from Hollywood Canteen.
So how did you come, as a child, how did you come to learn of your grandfather's work and the significance of it?
Well, I learned actually directly from him, I think, by the fact that as a child, two things. One, I saw a large sticker on the windshield of his car, which I used to ride in, it said WB. And so I said, what is that? And he said, well, that's Warner Brothers, where I used to work, spent many years there. Later, I was in school I think it was grammar school. We were taken into a room. It was a rainy day, and we saw a film about the American Revolution. It was in color, and there were the credits, M.K. Jerome and his partner, lyricist Jack Scholl. And I was very, very excited by that and very pleased. Later, of course, I spent a great deal of time with him. A lot of the time I spent as a child, he would accompany me when I played, usually playing cowboys and Indians in the 1950s. And Mo would accompany me at the piano, and that was wonderful. I enjoyed that immensely. And as the years went by, thanks to Mo's encouragement, his financial support, I became a historian. I went on to go to college and earn a PhD at UCLA. And eventually in 2016, I started to write The Tunesmith. And it took several years and was eventually published last July by Mare Manor Media.
And it's apparently received quite a bit of acclaim. I mean, just looking at the back of the cover, there are so many glowing reviews. I mean, it's small print.
Yes.
I always have to get my magnifying glass to read it. But among the people who are singing its praises, there's Leonard Maltin, a recent guest on the podcast, if I may drop a name there. Also, another prior guest, my friend Steve Bingen, with whom I worked at Warner Brothers a number of years ago. So, and I think you had mentioned that it's up for an award of some sort, right?
It is, yes. The Richard Hall Memorial Award given out by the Theater Library Association. I received the nomination a few weeks ago, and the eventual winner will be announced, unfortunately, in October. So I have a long wait to see if I'm an also-ran or not.
Well, it's a long time to keep you in suspense.
Right. I guess it's nice to be nominated. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Well, now, you mentioned in describing his career, you mentioned Tin Pan Alley, and this is one of those terms that I think a lot of us who are fans of older films and obviously music of that era, we're somewhat familiar with. We hear the term used, but other than the context, I don't know how many people really know specifically what it was. Can you just kind of describe what Tin Pan Alley actually was?
It was a section of New York where songwriters were playing their songs and hoping that people would listen to them, come and see them, and it just got the name Tin Pan Alley. Mo arrived there. I think the first published song that he had was in 1914, and then he went to work for Irving Berlin as a song plugger. Irving Berlin had a profound impact on his career and on his life. Irving Berlin actually changed his name from Irving Berlin to Irving Bylin, then back to Irving Berlin. And so Mo emulated him in the early days of his career on Tin Pan Alley. He too changed his name to become M.K.K.A.Y. Jerome. Or he would be known as Mo Krause during the early days of his career. But certainly after 1917, after World War I, he changed it to M.K. Jerome.
The initials, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Oh, and by the way, I should probably interject here that people who have listened to various episodes of the podcast would be aware that I like to drop in audio clips here and there to kind of punctuate things. But here, the irony is that we're talking about songs and music, but there you get into all kinds of licensing issues and things like that, and whether a song itself might have fallen into public domain. That doesn't mean a specific recording or artist's work on it has likewise. So it's really dicey, and they have all sorts of AI things to scan these and shut them down if they run into something that they don't like. So we're just kind of avoiding that just so we don't have to worry that this episode is not going to be available in, you know, one country or one market or another, or that sort of thing. However, Gary, you know, if you feel like you know, bursting into song or whistling or humming or anything like that. I think we could probably get away with that. I don't know that the AI would be quite that good. So I just want to let you know.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think I did inherit something of my grandfather's talents. I have a very good ear. I can pick out not only his songs, but the songs of a number of other famous composers. Obviously, John Williams is very easy. Elmer Bernstein, John Barry.
I love John Barry.
Yeah, and many more. But as for a singer, I think when I was younger, I had a relatively good voice. I recall singing The Lady is a Tramp, oddly enough, to my young daughter, Joanna. So I can't sing, unfortunately.
Ah, well, that's okay. Now, obviously, Mo could, though. Now, you mentioned him being a song plugger. And although before it gets away from me, I want to just clarify, too, in terms of being a songwriter, he actually was the composer of the music as opposed to the lyricist. He teamed with lyricists. So it wasn't like a Neil Diamond who does both, or Billy Joel, you know, that sort of thing, right?
Yes, that's right. He wrote the music.
And one of his fellow song pluggers was actually Harry Ruby, who Marx Brothers fans will immediately, you know, their ears will perk up, you know, due to the work that he did and things like Hooray for Captain Spaulding.
Right. But
in terms of a song plugger, we may have seen it depicted in some classic films. In fact, you speak of Sinatra. It's been a while since I've seen the movie, but I'm thinking the film, I believe it happened in Brooklyn. I'm thinking that he performed in that as a song plugger. I'm not 100% sure. I think Judy Garland also in Me and My Gal. Those are two that come to mind. And I could be wrong on both of them. But could you just tell us actually what a song plugger was?
Well, a song plugger would, in my grandfather's case, go out and promote the songs that were owned by the company that he worked for. And in the early part of my grandfather's career, I think around 1913 or 14, he went to work for Waterson, Snyder, and Berlin. Berlin being Irving Berlin. And I've already mentioned about changing his name because of Berlin, but he also had a profound impact on Mo professionally, because Berlin constantly told him, to succeed in this business, you have to give people what they want. And so if you don't, your career will go up and then it will go down. I think initially, say in 1914, he wrote a song called Along the Yukon Trail, which I don't think was a hit, but he continued to listen very carefully to what the public was hearing, keeping attuned to what was happening both musically and around the world. I mean, his first big hit was a World War I song. It's called Just a Baby's Prayer at Twilight for Her Father Over There. It sold 3 million copies in sheet music and was the second most popular song of the second decade of the 20th century. It also became popular during World War II and was recorded by several artists then as well. In many ways, it was the most successful song of his career until he ran into a fellow named James Taylor, but that comes later.
Yeah. And as a song plugger, his job was to, I guess it was primarily to sell the sheet music as opposed to records. Or, I mean, I guess it would have been some of both ultimately, but during the time he was doing it, was it primarily sheet music?
It was primarily sheet music.
And where would he go to do his song plugging?
He would go all over New York City. He would go also to Newark, New Jersey. Went to Long Island, of course. That's where he met Ray Meyer, an Orthodox rabbi's daughter, who he married. And soon they had a child named Jerome. So that's probably the origin of him changing his name from Krauss to Jerome.
Makes sense. And in what kind of venues would he do the song plugging?
Nickelodeons, all sorts of clubs like Pastor's Club, Chauncey Alcott's Club. He later wrote musicals about both men and the women who also were song pluggers as well as composers.
being a composer, was he able to plug his own songs? Or, I mean, I know working for the company, he'd be plugging the company's songs, but was a portion of those his own stuff?
A lot of it was his own stuff, yes. And as the time went by, as we went from World War I through the 1920s, the songs of the 20s that Mo wrote were either patriotic songs like Baby's Prayer or entertainment songs like Jula Jula Jing Ving or a Harry Ruby and Bert Kalmar song, Sally Green, the Village Vamp. And in the 20s, the popular songs which Mo emulated were jazz songs. And the first big hit that he had was in 1920, writing with Blanche Merrill, Jazz Baby.
Oh, yeah.
Your audience probably knows the Carol Channing version of it.
Right, from Thoroughly Modern Millie, yeah.
Right.
But the thing that surprised me about that when I was reading about it in the book was that you indicated that that song then was adopted by Wheaties for a jingle that was used on radio. And then it clicked with me because my dad used to have some vinyl records of old radio programs. One of them was the program Jack Armstrong, and Wheaties was the sponsor, and they had that jingle in there. So once I read that in your book, it immediately popped into my head, and I said, wow, yeah, that's the same tune.
He sold it for about $40 to General Mills, but other people went on to use the theme. Obviously, Carol Channing, Richard Linklater, the director, made a film called Orson Welles and Me, and the theme from Jazz Baby, the Wheaties theme, can be heard being sung by the star, the male star, in that film.
Well, one other aspect that I found fascinating in your book was talking about, as you said, they're plugging the songs largely to sell sheet music. And in many cases, people didn't necessarily have a piano in their house or anything to perform the song. They were buying it for the artwork, the cover art that was done for them. That was a lot of thought and effort went into that, and people used it as decor.
Yeah, it was a cheap way to have a piece of art. And that became a kind of collector's item for people. I mean, again, Baby's Prayer Twilight had a beautiful sheet music cover by Albert Barbella, and that sold 3 million copies.
Wow.
So either it was the song or the sheet music that appealed to them the most. One of my friends who actually was kind enough to say nice things about the Tunesmith, Norman von Holzenberg, is a specialist in sheet music and has written a beautiful book, coffee table book, collection of sheet music. And I, too, have a very large collection, mostly of my grandfather's songs, of course. But Norm's book has led me to look further, and I think he's working on another. Hmm. So it's a beautiful way to, even now, to collect art.
Sure. Yeah. Now, as we move along, ultimately, you alluded to this earlier on, the career that Mo had at Warner Brothers. So as movies are coming along, he's established as a songwriter, a composer. So how do movies capture him?
Well, of course, as early as 1929, Warner Brothers very aggressively sought to employ as many of the New York Tin Pan Alley songwriters as they could find. I think in April 1929, Mo signed a contract for something like $200 a week. But of course, in 1929, $200 a week in 23 or 4 prices is like $2,500 a week.
Yeah, so, not bad.
Yeah, so it wasn't a bad way to earn a living if you were successful at it.
Yeah. Well, and he was obviously right there as Hollywood was beginning to release sound pictures. Of course, now the early ones, the one that immediately springs to mind is kind of representative of this, Don Juan with John Barrymore. Before the Jazz Singer came along, they were already putting out some films with not synchronized dialogue or anything like that, but with specific recordings of music. And Mo obviously accomplished that. He was there for that, including one that you mentioned in there that I thought was fascinating, a movie called The Single Standard with Greta Garbo. And my first thought is, wow, did Greta Garbo sing? But I guess not. I mean, I haven't seen the film. It is available, I noticed, through Warner Archive Collection. But I'm curious.
It's a silent movie.
Yeah.
It's a silent movie.
Yeah. For practical purposes, it is a silent movie with this recorded soundtrack. And so I'm curious as to how his song was utilized in that.
I really don't know. As I say, because it was a silent movie, I don't think I even bothered to listen to it. I know he wrote the song with a wonderful lyricist who would go on to have a fabulous Hollywood career, Ned Washington. Ned joined Mo in Los Angeles sometime after 1929. Yeah.
And then he also apparently had a significant presence in the Vitaphone shorts.
Yes, yes. It said that he's the first songwriter to actually record one of the Gunn sisters, an act of children, which was popular. And the young daughter changed her name to Judy Garland and went on, of course, to have a wonderful career in music and movies. A kind of sad ending to it, but in some ways a typical Hollywood ending.
Right. And his song was used for her. It was a short called Bubbles.
That's right. Yes.
And apparently that's one of them that's available. Well, also the Warner Archive Collection. I believe there are a couple of volumes at least of Vitaphone shorts, so it's in there somewhere. But then he shows up, you know, before too long, not just having his song in the film, but he's on camera in Show of Shows.
Yes. 1929, Show of Shows was a huge Warner Brothers project. Everyone who worked at the studio, including my grandfather, was forced to participate. So you not only had movie stars or people about to become movie stars, Loretta Young and many others. In most cases, he had to write and, who knows, perhaps sing a song to a woman. I think it was probably the woman was a singer, an Italian woman. But Song of Songs had everything. It was 100 songs for 100 stars, it was described as.
Yeah, I guess Show of Shows was kind of Warner Brothers' version of what all the studios were doing at that point with sound to show off everybody on their roster. So Paramount had Paramount on Parade. MGM had Hollywood Review of 1929.
Right. You mentioned John Barrymore earlier. Mm-hmm. John Barrymore appeared in Show of Shows doing one of his soliloquies. Mo wrote a song besides the song for the Italian singer. He wrote a song for one of the featured stars of Show of Shows, Georges Portier, a French boxer who actually didn't have a very good boxing career, but he appeared in the movie and there's a huge number featuring him and then the song itself as a number of people did strange calisthenics. Jumping jack, climbing all over parts of the set. It's not considered, at least by professional critics, as being a particularly good movie, but it was quite a great success at the time. The New York police had to handle the crowds, which turned up when it debuted in New York.
Wow. And Mo, is that the one where he's a pirate?
That's right. To my delight as a child, I could brag to my friend that my grandfather was a pirate. Frank Fay was the host of Show of Shows. And in addition to writing the song and being the pirate, he wrote the song for Georges Carpentier, a French boxer, poor man's Maurice Chevalier. But eventually, Mo decided to leave Warner Brothers in February 1939. The movies, which had been so attractive to songwriters initially, certainly in 1929, attractive enough to lure him to leave a promising career as a songwriter and to move to Los Angeles, much to my grandmother's disappointment, because she, most of her family lived on Long Island. She had sisters there. a brother-in-law she liked, and she was not happy. But he went. He went. He thought he could handle and had handled just about every style of music, dance music, you know, tango, jazz songs he'd written.
Yeah, you talk about how versatile he was with different genres, including some that had specific styles associated with them that he didn't necessarily have the background for, you would think, like Polynesian music or cowboy music.
That's right.
And I was fascinated that he did a bunch of songs for a singing cowboy that Dick Foran starred as.
Yes, but before I talk a little bit about Dick Foran, I'd like to just talk a little bit about some of his 1920s music, which became very popular in addition to Just a Baby's Prayer or Jazz Baby, was published in 1920. He wrote songs for everyone. One of them actually did very, very well. It talked about a popular murder case of the 1920s. The Car Wanderer story, which was later written about by journalist Ben Hecht and Charles MacArthur. Wanderer had been a veteran of World War I. He'd come home, but his happy years were as a soldier, and he missed being in the Army. So he was not happy being married to Mrs. Wanderer and decided that he would hire a man to pretend to hold them up and accost them in the vestibule of their apartment house, and a gunfight ensued. Mrs. Wanderer and the baby she was carrying was killed, and the case became a sensation. Eventually, he was executed at Joliet Prison for his crimes, and just before Wanderer was hanged by the neck until he died, he sang a song that Moe wrote about loneliness. Old pal, why don't you answer me? Wow. And that became, again, one of the great hits of the 1920s. And Moe would go on, even in the 1950s and 40s, to talk about that story, the Wanderer story, and Old Pal, to newspaper men and on radio.
Wow. Yeah, that's a dark association. Jumping back a bit, am I remembering correctly that Show of Shows was around the time that he became associated with Brian Foy? Brian Foy being one of the seven little Foys of vaudeville fame.
I don't know if any of the Foys were in that movie. I'm more confident of the early 30s when Foy did his film work. He was a major player in a film that Moe worked on when he went back to New York in the early 1930s, Merton Marge. It was a very popular radio show initially, and then it went on to become quite a successful movie. And actually, it did have the famous Foy brother starring in it, and it did very, very well.
It was in association with Brian Foy in his role as producer that he did those Dick Foran singing cowboy westerns. Is that
correct?
That's
right. Okay. That's right. Yes. Yes. Yeah. I mean, Foy as a producer was very productive. He made hundreds of movies. He kept repeating the same stories over and over again. He wasn't worried a bit, although actors often complained to him that, you know, I keep losing arms and legs. You keep remaking the movie and I lose my left arm and then I lose my right arm. My career will die once I lose both arms unless you go on to focus on my legs. And of course that happened too. But among the things that Foy did as the keeper of the bees, as he was known, was to create a series of Western movies starring Dick Foran. Now, all of the studios, or many of them, had actors portraying cowboys. John Wayne did one. Roy Rogers did one. Gene Autry did one. Both Roy Rogers and Gene Autry recorded some of Moe's songs. And the Dick Foran series was among the most popular for a period of time. In fact, as an acting cowboy, he got more fan mail than anybody else at the studio in the 1930s at Warner Brothers.
Wow.
Eventually, of course, his career waned, but among his greatest hits was My Little Buckaroo, which was recorded by Bing Crosby. I'm sorry if you're hearing my dog in the background.
That's okay. I'm just glad you haven't heard mine yet.
And Mo went on to write for a dozen Dick Foran westerns. And each of those movies had multiple songs, anywhere from one to three or four. So sometimes, and these movies were done just about yearly in the early to mid-30s. So he'd write, the producer would say, I want this kind of song. And he would have to crank it out, he and Jack Scholl doing the lyrics. So he would wind up, say, 1937, 38. Writing something like 47 songs just for this one series.
Wow. Well, and of course, again, going back to talking about Warner Brothers as such, he was connected with some of the major productions there, including a bunch with James Cagney.
Yes. It's unusual when a star becomes a friend of a person who works behind the scenes. I think I'm correct in calling Mo's relationship with James Cagney as a kind of friendship, that they weren't real close, but Mo seemed to work on almost every Cagney film, going back even to the earliest ones, Public Enemy, songs like that. But of course, not been a surprise, you see, that Cagney asked him to work on Yankee Doodle Dandy, which was also directed by Michael Curtiz.
Oh, yeah.
Who would go on to direct many fine movies. I mean, he again was such a director of variety of movies. He could make a movie like Yankee Doodle Dandy, a biography of George M. Cohan, as well as films like Robin Hood and Captain Blood, the early Errol Flynn movies that Curtiz directed.
Yeah, there was a while back on Facebook, somebody posed the question, if you could only watch the films of one director for the rest of your life, who would it be? And I thought, well, I think it's got to be Michael Curtiz. I mean, you know, Yankee Doodle Dandy, Casablanca, White Christmas, Adventures of Robin Hood, King Creole, and lots of others that aren't immediately coming to mind, but that are just really entertaining.
You can skip the later ones. I love Westerns, enjoyed Comancheros, which was one of Curtiz's last films. It had John Wayne and it had Lee Marvin in a particularly juicy role.
Speaking of, and I mentioned it a moment ago, Casablanca. Now, Mo had a composition in there that he did a couple, but one of which is particularly noteworthy, in which the song essentially acts as a character in terms of having an impact on what's happening on the action on screen.
Yes, he and Jack Scholl together wrote a song called Knock on Wood, which became a very popular song. You know, everyone, they mention Casablanca, they think about As Time Goes By, which of course is a wonderful song, but it wasn't written specifically for the film, as was Knock on Wood, and That's What Noah Done, which Hal Wallace, the producer, cut out of the movie. Mo wasn't really too crazy about the man who played Sam in the film.
Dooley Wilson.
Dooley Wilson, yes. He got the name Dooley, of course, by playing in minstrel shows where he wore blackface, even though he was black, but he couldn't play the piano, for example. And so another person actually played Knock on Wood and all the other songs, popular songs of the day that are featured in Casablanca.
But the interesting thing to me about the use of that song is it's playing during a sequence where something very important is happening on screen.
Yes, yes. It was designed to be a call and response song, where the camera would focus for a time on Dooley Wilson and then shift to the darkness of the club, Rick's club. And that shift gave the cameraman the opportunity to shift from light to darkness, in which Humphrey Bogart, as Rick Blaine, comes in and puts the vital letters of transit by which Ingrid Bergman and Paul Henreid were able to escape from Casablanca. It was a popular song. The movie, of course, is often thought of as the greatest American film ever made, according to 60 Minutes.
And it's Leonard Maltin's favorite.
Is it really?
Yeah. Now, you referred to one that was cut from the film, That's What Noah Done. And
yes.
I'm curious, I know that on the DVD set that I have, it's a two-disc set, there are outtakes of scenes that have no audio, but there are also some recording session clips of the songs and the music being recorded. And there is a portion of That's What Noah Done among those song clips, but there's no complete scene. So I'm wondering.
I think you should have it. You should have it on one of those.
Maybe one of the later editions had a more complete version, but I was curious about that.
Although it was cut, it was designed to be a very big song for Dooley Wilson, but unfortunately it was cut.
I'll have to check out those other editions, see if it's on those in a more complete form. Now, you mentioned earlier, well, first of all, let me ask this. Of all the different styles of music that Mo composed, do you know if he had a particular favorite genre?
Well, as I say, as a songwriter on Tin Pan Alley, he kept tuned to popular taste. Focused on world events, so you'd have patriotic songs, you'd have songs that appealed to the South. Huddle Up Blues, My Mammy Knows, were sung by Al Jolson. And of course, he had never gone to the South at all when he lived in New York and wrote most of those Southern songs. And Harry Ruby didn't either. He mentioned supposedly for being criticized for writing those songs when he'd never seen it. And he said, you know, it was all right. No one knows where the Suwannee River actually is. And, you know, I'm doing just fine.
Now, earlier you kind of teased this, so I want to lead into it now. You mentioned James Taylor. And that connection between Mo and James comes along quite a few years later. So can you tell us what that consists of?
Yes. In 2020, I received word from my friend Janet Reutz, a singer and popular student of Mo's music, had her own show on radio. And she wrote actually a memoir of her relationship with Mo in the book. So the variety of songs was just awe-inspiring. I mean, he just did songs for every style of movie. He didn't seem to favor songs. I mean, it was difficult for Warner Brothers to force you to favor one certain style because you had to do so much and so much different kind of music. So he did Westerns. He did World War II movies, The Bombardier, which became famous as the theme song of the men who flew as bombardiers during World War II. He won a prize from the Treasury Department for writing a song for buying war bonds. So the system seemed to favor variety over a single style. And of course, the music then was quite different from what James Taylor would later do as a singer and songwriter, doing both those jobs, unlike the way Mo wrote. Taylor found this song. The song had begun as one of the Warner Brothers B movies, Over the Goal. I'm not sure if it was a Foy movie. Probably was. It took place on the set of a fictitious college where the students set out to steal their opponent's mascot and that way receive a huge contribution from an alumni.
So Over the Goal being a football reference.
Yes. There was a football craze in the 1930s. So Over the Goal fit in quite nicely with that 1937, I believe. By the time Taylor heard it, it had been transformed from a movie into a Warner Brothers cartoon called Catnip College, I think in 1938. And growing up in North Carolina in the 1950s, Taylor somehow saw the cartoon and just loved as easy as rolling off a log. And so he went on to record it and to put it on his album, American Standard, which won him a Grammy, one of many of his Grammys. And I had initially great hopes that maybe it would appeal to a 21st century audience. Doesn't seem to, although as far as the royalties are concerned, they're not terribly, terribly big. But I think the advance we've received can be explained by James Taylor recording it, making a music video out of it, and just giving it more attention than it certainly ever originally received.
Do you, among all the songs that Mo composed, do you have a favorite?
Well, I love My Little Buckaroo. I love Some Sunday Morning from San Antonio. I love songs that he wrote for Van Johnson and Jane Wyman in the mid-1950s. He wrote a song about a racehorse. I think it was the only film about a racehorse that he ever had to write a song for, Glory. I don't think it did terribly well, but I guess that's among my favorite songs.
Okay. What would you say are the best sources for seeking out his music? I mean, obviously, you know, you can find the movies that you've mentioned and that are specified in your book, but in terms of just, you know, if you want to hear the songs and maybe some songs that aren't associated with a movie.
Well, I mean, my book has a section of songs that are associated with his movies that we haven't talked about, like Swing Your Lady with Humphrey Bogart and many of the other songs, and Some Sunday Morning with Errol Flynn and Alexis Smith and many other songs as well.
I'm guessing that if you just typed his name into Amazon Music, you wouldn't necessarily get a lot coming back because that's going to be more artist-based.
There's a section in my book that mentions the songs that are associated with his films and other songs that I also dislike as well. So that's one source. I mean, you can pick up old sheet music from Amazon or eBay.
Right. And I guess having that resource in your book with the titles, then something like Amazon Music, you could type in the song title and see what comes up. You might find multiple artists having recorded the same song.
Yes.
All right. Well, that presents just a really nice overview of the career of Mo, or as he's more formally known, M.K. Jerome. Once again, we're talking to Gary May about his grandfather and the career documented in the book, The Tunesmith, The Musical Journey of M.K. Jerome, available from Bear Manor. And there incidentally will be a link on the bookshelf page of the Movie Nights and Matinees website. So you can click on that. It'll take you to Amazon. You can see a little more about the book and order it as well. So at this point, Gary, it's time for me to ask you the question that I ask all my guests. And that is, what is your most memorable movie going experience?
Well, I've had several of them associated primarily with the fact that Mo used to take me with him after he became a member of the Motion Picture Academy. In the days that Mo was working, in order to receive or to be nominated for an Oscar, you actually had to have had the song in a film. That would later change, and songwriters as well as actors not only participated, but agents, dietitians who become members of the Academy. But I suppose the greatest experience I had was not watching one of Mo's films, but of watching The Exorcist.
Okay. That was out of left field. I've had several guests say Star Wars. Several have said, the Abel Gance silent epic Napoleon. Nobody so far has mentioned The Exorcist. So, I mean, I'm sure that's a memorable movie for a lot of people, but in what way was it memorable in your case?
Well, it was memorable for me because my wife and I saw it at a special showing at the Academy Theater. And Robert Knudsen and another sound expert won an Oscar for the sound. This huge machine was in the middle of the theater, and they were literally working on the film as we were watching it. So here was an Academy audience. These are professional film people, maybe Oscar winners themselves. I can't recall who was there that night, except for the people who were surrounding the director. But having been a member of the Academy, I got not only to see The Exorcist, but many movies over the years which were nominated for Academy Awards. So I have many memories, for example, of Irene Dunn, who was my mother's favorite movie star of the 30s. She dropped her glasses on the floor, and I was a child, and I crawled down and found them under the seat and gave them to her. And she was very happy about it, of course, get her glasses back. And my mother was even more thrilled because she was her favorite movie star next to Bette Davis. I also saw many popular actors of the day who became Academy members. Frederick March, I guess a little early than some of the others, but he was there one night and he put his arm around my chair. It was a crowded showing that night, and so they put sort of old chairs on the aisle, and he sat next to me, and he put his arm around my chair and was almost continually drumming his fingers against the chair. And I, in annoyance, I turned to my grandfather to complain, and he said, "Just live with it. The guy's won 2 Oscars. So besides seeing Frederick March and others, I saw Natalie Wood, Robert Wagner, Sal Mineo, almost the entire cast of Rebel Without a Cause. I saw a number of Glenn Ford movies, Cimarron, the second version of it.
Right.
Maria Schell as well. So it was a wonderful experience for me. In fact, Mo would let me sometimes, and I guess I'm embarrassed to admit that he let me do the voting. And I found that a terrific way to get a date for the weekend, because a young woman would want to go and vote for the Oscars.
That's a unique pickup line. You know, hey, want to see my Oscar ballot?
Right. Right. I mean, if I really liked them, I could take him over to Herbert Magnuson's house, who won the first Academy Award for Best Song, which was sung by Fred Astaire. I don't think I, Gail, did I ever? I'm asking my wife if I ever took you over to the Magnuson's house. No. Just to see his Oscar?
No, I didn't. No, you never took me.
No, I didn't.
Wow. I hope I haven't triggered a rift as a result of this revelation or anything. No. All right. Well, Gary, I want to thank you for joining me and spending your time and your patience. We had some very challenging technical issues that popped up along the way here, but it's been well worth it. And I just am really grateful that we have finally we've pulled it off. So thank you again for joining me on Movie Nights and Matinees.
You're very welcome, Bill. It's been a great pleasure. I hope people will read the book, and if they have any reaction to it, they'd like to write me. Here's my email address, garymay@udel.edu. Okay. I look forward to hearing from you.
Okay. Well, we'll get that on the Facebook page then, so that'll be easy access. Hope the rest of your weekend goes well, and we'll be seeing you down the road.
Right. Thanks so much.
As I mentioned, you'll find Gary's book, The Tunesmith, on the bookshelf page of the Movie Nights and Matinees website. And on the screening room page, you'll find links to a bunch of feature films and at least one short subject in which the songs of M.K. Jerome, a.k.a. Mo, are incorporated. Don't forget to click on the follow, subscribe, or download button wherever you listen, and please leave a rating and, where possible, a review. Spread the word, far and wide, near and high, or above and beyond, whichever fits your situation. Also, don't forget to swing by the Movie Nights and Matinees Facebook page, where you can leave comments and sometimes find some unique photos shared by our guests. Thanks for your patience waiting for this episode to drop. The usual bi-weekly schedule has been thrown off, at least for the time being, but with any luck, you actually won't have to wait another 2 weeks for episode 29. Until then...
Why don't we just... wait here for a little while. See what happens.